Well, brethren, this coming week we will anticipate the return of Jesus Christ to the earth by keeping the Feast of Trumpets. We will look for that day, not just this Thursday, but anticipating the Christ's return, as we heard, even more than a sparkly green metallic Schwinn 10-speed. What did Christ tell us to watch for so that we can be ready for His return? Today we'll examine what Jesus Christ told His people to watch for so we might be prepared in anticipation of His actual arrival to the earth. And we're going to do that by examining what Christ told His disciples in Matthew chapter 24. So if you turn with me to Matthew chapter 24, Jesus is actually asked by His disciples how they could know that He was going to be returning. What would they watch for? Now, what we need to do as you're turning to Matthew chapter 24 is remind ourselves of the greatest misunderstanding in first century Judaism about the coming of the Messiah. The greatest misunderstanding that Judaism possessed was that there was only one coming of the Messiah. They simply did not grasp that Christ would come, the Son of God, to die for the sins of humankind. So time after time after time, Christ is reminding His disciples that He is going to die. And not once did they really get it. Even after He died, they still quite didn't understand the issue of these two comings and how much time would separate the first coming and the second coming. When we look here in Matthew chapter 24 in verse 1, we read about Jesus going out from the temple. Jesus went out and departed from the temple. So He walks out of this glorious facility that Herod had largely constructed out of tax funds. And again, Herod did so to keep peace. Now, Herod had become a Jew, but he did so primarily to please the people that he was ruling over so they wouldn't rebel. But he built quite a glorious facility, not nearly the glory of certainly the previous temples, but nonetheless quite a glorious facility. And for the Jews, this facility represented God's presence. So when Jesus walks out from the building, His disciples came up to show Him the buildings of the temple. So, disciples almost acting like tour guides. Said, did you notice how this is put together? Now, didn't Christ know those things? Well, of course He did. But Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. That would have been a stunning statement to the disciples. This temple represented God Himself. It represented God's presence in their nation. It represented them as the chosen people. How can you say this is all going to be torn to pieces? How could that possibly be? God's house being destroyed. Now, when it says not one stone of that temple will be left upon another, that came to pass. When the Romans burned the temple, apparently the gold that was covering many of the things melted and literally ran between the stones. And so Roman soldiers pried the stones apart one from another. And there was not left one stone of the temple. Now, part of a retaining wall exists to this day. It's called the Wailing Wall. And the Jews to this day go and pray at this wall. But that's not part of the temple. It was simply a wall to hold back dirt and to hold up areas. So this prophecy did come to pass. What we have here, then, is what is called the Olivet Prophecy, beginning in verse 3. Why is it called the Olivet Prophecy? Well, because theologians like to make up fancy names for things. It's called the Olivet Prophecy because Christ prophesied while he sat on the Mount of Olives. So when you hear the Olivet Prophecy referred to, it's referring to what's stated here in Matthew 24. So verse 4, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives. Again, this was a shocking statement. None of this is going to survive. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And they were stunned by this. What do you mean? This is all going to be torn apart. They were God's chosen people, were they not? This was God's symbol of presence with them. What do you mean it's going to be torn down? So the disciples talked about this, and they came to him, tell us, when will these things be? How can this be the case? There are, in essence, two or three questions. They're asking, when will these things be? And a second question, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now, interestingly, in their minds, because they did not yet understand the two comings of the Messiah. The first one to die as a sacrifice of sin for the world's sins, for human sin. The second time as the conquering king. Because they didn't understand that, they're lumping all these things together. You see, from our perspective, after the first coming and awaiting the second coming, we see these words very differently than the apostles did. They were lumping all these things together. When's this going to happen? What are the signs? When are you coming? Now, would they be thinking about what we think about? Are they thinking, what's the sign of your coming? In the clouds, great glory. They're not thinking that. When they say, what's the sign of your coming? They're thinking, coming to the fore. Coming to the top. Taking over. They're not thinking the way we think. We cannot project our understanding 2,000 years later back to what they were thinking. They thought Christ was living, going to live, that he was going to take over the government of the Romans and kick them out, that he was going to raise Israel up to the top again, the way they were supposed to be as God's chosen people, the way the Torah says, the way the first five books of the Bible describe, the way the prophets constantly talk about. They were looking forward to this spot being the place where all nations would flow. To where? To Mount Zion, to the temple. That's what they're thinking about. So when they ask about his coming, they weren't thinking of Christ coming from heaven through the clouds to the earth to rule. What's the sign of your coming? To the fore, to the top, to step up and finally claim your role as Messiah. So it's important we understand that. That's what they're talking about. When we think of the sign of his coming, we project 1,000, 2,000 years into the future from this statement. And we can see things that the disciples could not see at that time, only because history has played out in this area. So he sits on the Mount of Olives. Now, the Olivet Prophecy contains about five different threads of information. The destruction of Jerusalem is one of those threads. Both the destruction of Jerusalem anciently and, now from our perspective, a second destruction of Jerusalem that is coming. A second thread that's described here in the Olivet Prophecy is a warning of persecution. A warning of persecution against the people of God. Not just God's people, but Israel in general. There's a third thread, and that is a warning of the dangers of the last days. So we'll read these things as we go through. Then a fourth thread is a warning regarding the second coming, to be prepared. And then the fifth is the warning to watch. These threads Christ tells his disciples about. Now again, his disciples at that time would have one perspective. We, thankfully, can see things they could not. verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? The destruction of the temple, all these things thrown down. And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" Now again, we look at the end of the age very differently than they did. The end of the age that they're talking about is the age of Israel being put down. Now they're looking for Israel to be raised to the fore again. Jesus answered and said, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." What do we begin seeing here? Well, what we begin seeing is that there are two possible meanings to what Christ is saying. First of all, he's projecting this far into the future. The disciples could not yet grasp that. So he begins answering them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." So for the disciples, they would need to understand some things about Christ and God's plan that they heretofore did not ever grasp. And the easiest thing would be for them to be deceived. So the first thing he says, "Many will come in my name saying, 'I'm the Christ.'" So what is he intending there? Well, when he died, they would receive the shock of their lives. They wouldn't comprehend it just yet. But he says, some are going to come in my name saying, "I'm the Christ," and they'll deceive many. Well, how would that be the case? Well, he's again projecting off into the future. Were there some during the apostles' lifetime who would say that they were the Christ or representing Christ? And would they deceive many? And the answer is, of course they would. Yes, they would. But he's also intending this as a dual prophecy for our day as well. That there will be, over the centuries, over the course of time, many that will come saying that they either are Christ, the Messiah himself, or they will simply say, "Well, Jesus is the Christ," but they'll deceive many. So what is more prevalent today? What is more prevalent are those who say Jesus is the Christ, but they deceive many. Because they take the name of Christ and yet attach it to all kinds of heretical, false, pagan teachings. So they're saying Jesus is Lord. They're saying Jesus is the Christ. But they're deceiving many because they attach his name to completely non-biblical, false teaching. So the first thing that Christ warned about is the issue of false religion. And not just false religion, but false Christianity, more specifically. So there will be a few who will say they themselves are Christ. They themselves are the Messiah. But far more prevalent are those who will say, "Yes, Jesus is the Christ. You should love the Lord. Give your heart to the Lord." But will deceive many because they are teaching non-biblical truths. They're teaching falsehoods. So this false religion. Now, again, you may want to stick a little card here, your 3x5 in Matthew 24. Let's look at Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6 is a parallel to what Christ said in Matthew chapter 24. And this parallel gives the time sequence. Christ gives the outline in Matthew 24, and then Revelation often provides the time sequence of the events described. In Revelation chapter 6 in verse 1, "Now I saw, when the Lamb opened one of the seals, I heard four living creatures saying, with a voice like thunder, 'Come and see.' And I looked," of course you hear a voice like thunder that says, "Come and look," you step up real quick. It's like when your daddy told you as a little boy, "Son, come here." Whoa, you didn't say, "Why?" Well, if you did, you'd wear his handprint in very tender areas. Come and see. And I looked, and behold, a white horse. A white horse. And he who sat on it had a bow. What is interesting is they have something very similar in Revelation chapter 19, describing Jesus Christ himself riding on a white horse. Is this what's being described here? No, this is a counterfeit. It says, he had sat on a white horse, he had a bow, crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. This symbol of the white horse with a bow is a counterfeit of Jesus Christ. It's the exact same thing Christ mentions in Matthew chapter 24. That there would be those who will claim Jesus is Christ, but they will deceive many. So when we look at the world, and the world specifically of Christianity, we find that most have been deceived. That they may be well-meaning, but the white horse described here and the person sitting on that horse has conquered them, has deceived them, has taken them captive. Now, when he says conquering, you know, there are some who will say, well, this is just talking about Jesus Christ. Same thing as Revelation 19. No, Christ does not conquer in this way, not described that way at all. He will put down rebellion. He doesn't go out to conquer. So what's described here is false religion. So what are we looking for? What I'd suggest is take that 3x5 card out of Matthew 24 and slide it in here to Revelation 6. We'll jump back and forth a few times in the next few minutes. What are we watching for? We are watching for false Christianity to grow in influence. Now, prophetically speaking, that's hard to swallow. Why is that hard to swallow today? Why do most people not believe that's the case? Well, it's because of Christianity's lessening influence around the world. There seems to be, in general terms, at least in the areas that we're familiar with, areas like North America, areas like Northern Europe, there's a lessening of the authority and the power of Christianity. That is simply not true in Southern Europe, nor is it true in South America and places like that, and in Asia, where Christianity is actually growing in influence in many respects. But what will it take? It will take miracle workers to restore the image of false Christianity around the world. So what are we watching for? You will not see traditional churches growing, traditional Christian churches growing in numbers until there are serious trials and tribulations, or there are miracles worked to cause people to believe again. There is nothing on the horizon at this point for people to believe in traditional Christianity. No reason for it to grow. But as disasters loom and grow, people turn to God. And when there are those who can work miracles, or at least false miracles, then Christianity will grow. So we're watching for those things. The disciples at that time could not really have grasped this in the same way. They would, verse 6. Back to Matthew 24 and verse 6. What else are we watching for? What are the signs awaiting Christ's return? Verse 6. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. It's been said there are more wars on the planet today than virtually any other time during human history. I think someone recently calculated only 6 nations on earth are not currently involved in some kind of hot or cold war. That's fast. That's unbelievable. And yet the history of humanity is the history of war. Sad to say that that is the case. But he says, see that you are not troubled. So it's not war starting yet, but you're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars. In other words, this spirit of anger, as was mentioned earlier, certainly seems to pervade the world. We are living in a time of anger and upset and rudeness, it seems like never before. So we're watching for these wars. But see that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Now, for the apostles, they would hear of wars. They would hear of rumors of wars. There would be zealots among them who constantly fight the Romans and cause upset. In fact, it was the zealots who really brought the Romans when they finally decided to intervene. It was because of the zealots and what they were doing and the guerrilla warfare that they were carrying out at this time. So don't be troubled. So the end is not yet. Then verse 7 says what is going to be happening. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. In our generation, we've had two major conflagrations where kingdoms, groups of nations, have fought with one another, with the end result being probably 100 million people or more dying. Some put the casualties just of World War II at well over 100 million. Some say it's not quite that much, more like 48 million. But you're talking millions of casualties. So we are living in the time when nations rise against nations, kingdom against kingdom, and as a result of warfare. There will be, it says in verse 7, famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Now pause for a second there. Put your marker back here in Matthew 24 and turn to Revelation 6 again. Revelation 6. We read verses 1 and 2, how this false religion goes out and conquers people, will increase as time goes along in its deceptive power. Verse 3, when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come and see." And another horse, this one fiery red, went out. And it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another. And there was given to him a great sword. So the second thing that Christ told us to watch for that would be a sign of his coming is this ever-increasing warfare on the planet. And when you have millions of people dying, you can certainly see why a few decades back Mr. Herbert Armstrong would have said, we are in the end time. Never before have we had a situation where millions of people have died as a result of warfare. Millions. We're talking simply 6 million Jews in Europe were put to death by the Nazis. That's just a small section of Europe by a small government in one sense. Millions of Russians died in that conflagration. Millions elsewhere. So we're talking, well, no wonder he must have thought, this is it. This is not just war and rumors of wars. This is a kingdom rising against kingdom. And we're talking about millions of casualties. When you talk about the Korean Peninsula, when you talk about Japan, when you talk about China, all these areas firing, in fire, or up in smoke, we might say. Millions of lives lost. No wonder he must have thought that that was the end, that it was coming now. And yet, the end was not yet. This fiery horse. So we're entering a time, it seems, again, let's go back to Matthew chapter 24, entering a time of greater and greater warfare, greater and greater anger, greater and greater upset. We'll see that continuing. There's no doubt that with terrorism as it is globally accepted that terrorism is worse today than ever before. Than ever before. The number of people that are angry about things, whether it's about religious things, and usually it's not about religion, it's about selfishness, and I want what other people have, and if I can use religion as an excuse to pursue that, all the better. And so we talk about religious wars, which really aren't religious wars, they're just grasps for stuff, just to get things. And if I can get from them what they have, then I'll take it. So So again, in verse 6, you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, Matthew 24, 6. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Now, for me, it's hard not to be troubled when war is on your doorstep. Yet he says, trust me, I'll take care of you. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, there'll be war. So there will be warfare. So we are watching for these wars to continue to increase. It should not surprise us. There have been more terrorist attacks in the UK in the last 6 months than since the time of the Irish Republican Army bombing on a regular basis. So more than ever before on their, in their records. So we'll see these things continuing to increase. At some point, Europeans will get fed up with Muslims. At some point, it's going to happen. Oh, yeah, well, we can say it's just the extremists. Well, that may be the case. But at some point, they're going to say, you are not like us. Get out. And you can imagine the upset that that's going to cause. So we'll watch those things. We'll see if those things is the way God will bring these things to pass. What's the result then of nation rising against nation, of there being war? The rest of verse 7, there will be famines. It's estimated that nearly 750 million people on earth today do not have anywhere near adequate nutrition. And much of that is due to war. Because when there's war, you cannot have peace long enough to grow crops. So, what do warring factions do? They strive to destroy the food-making capacities of their enemies. Because if they can starve them to death, they don't have to shoot them. And so we have it's estimated 795 million people, in essence, in danger of starving to death today. It's 750 million people. So when we talk about there being 7 billion on the earth, and nearly 1 billion of those are starving, we're talking about 1 in 9 people on the earth. So when you have war, you have famines. And when you have war and you starve people to death, they cannot be healthy enough to fend off disease. So famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Turn back to Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. We read verses 1 through 4, the great sword at the end of verse 4. Verse 5, then he opened the third seal. And I heard the third living creature say, come and see. And so I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. You can picture this in your mind, this dark figure riding on this horse. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. What's he talking about? He's talking about food becoming extremely expensive. Small portions at great prices. He's talking about famines. Famines often ride on the heels of war. It's a tool of war. In fact, much of Africa has suffered this very tool over and over and over again. Starve your enemies so that they cannot fight against you. So we have famine. Now, that's not even to talk about the famine that is produced simply by weather and weather patterns. Because of stunningly amazing improvements in agriculture, we've been able to feed 7 billion people. Small changes in the weather would render that virtually impossible. So we'll see how God decides for this to be the case. Is climate change? Millennials, by the way, think the number one problem in the world is climate change. That's the number one problem. Almost 50% of millennials say the number one problem in the world is climate change. And they may not be far off. You might have an opinion about climate change and the facts and the figures and all those things. It's, to me, almost impossible to sort out. But if they're correct, could climate change be one of the ways that these famines come to pass. Could be. There's all kinds of dire predictions about that and all kinds of suggestions how to fix it. Now, one of the suggestions to fix it has to do with turning to God and repenting, which is the real solution. Nonetheless, famine will come. Continue on in verse 6. I heard the voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, a quart of denarius, three quarts of barley for a denarius. No harm to the oil and wine. It's not yet time for that. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard, can you ask, ask about that? Can you live on oil and wine? Well, you can drink your problems away and you can have nice skin by putting olive oil on it. But after that, it doesn't go very far to eat. Verse 7, he opened the fourth seal. I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come and see. And so I looked and behold a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death. And Hades, or the grave, followed him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. So what do we have here? Sword, hunger, death by the beasts of the earth. This fourth seal simply representing this terrible plagues of disease that will come upon the earth. So we watch for these things to take place. We ask, will some of these things be generated by human beings? Will things like genetic engineering produce some of these frightening possibilities, eventualities? That may be the case. Will it simply be things that are already in existence? I mean, you have all the conspiracy theorists that say, well, Ebola was created by the government to reduce the population. HIV was created by the government to reduce the population, etc., etc. Now, I don't know that there's a whole lot to believe in those things, but the bottom line is, humans often do not know what they're doing. And it is possible for some of these things to be unleashed unknowingly upon the population. It's going to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. So we might say, well, beasts of the earth, are you just going to have all kinds of lions roaming the earth? No. How about a chicken? How about a chicken? Well, you know, chicken gonna kill me? No, but bird flu certainly will. Asian bird flu will kill you. 60% of people who contract the avian flu die. 60%. So, can a chicken kill you? The beasts of the earth? Yeah, they don't have to attack you and, you know, chew your jugular. It's all kinds of. How about swine flu? Yeah, pigs can kill you in more ways than one. We don't have any pepperoni on Bellini's pizza today. We don't eat pigs. Can pigs kill you? Absolutely. As these, and again, you read what geneticists say, and they are terribly frightened themselves. And they, if they could pray to God, they would, because they see the possibilities of these diseases jumping between species. And it doesn't take much change, genetic change in one of those viruses, to create something like the Spanish flu of the late, you know, early part of the 20th century, where you had, what was it, 59 million people died from the Spanish flu. Some people contracted the flu in the morning and were dead, well, started having symptoms in the morning, were dead by nightfall. That's extremely vicious flu at that time. So there are those possibilities. Do we want to scare people? No. God's people are promised to be protected. But we watch for these things. We don't brush them off and say, well, humanity will figure it all out. We'll come up with some kind of a cure. You know, some people say, well, look at the great strides. You go to the UN website, you'll see, look at all the great strides that have been made against HIV. And that simply is a lie. There's been no progress against AIDS. Preventing AIDS simply has to do with morality. So the success of fewer AIDS cases today is telling people, if you sleep around, you're going to die. Don't do it. So they stop doing it. So there's fewer cases of AIDS. But there's no cure out there. There's no cure for that disease. Oh, can they lessen the symptoms with certain drugs? Well, yeah. It doesn't cure it. So when they say, oh, we'll work all this out, don't kid yourselves. It's simply not true. These things are incurable in some respects. Now, will some of those find cures? Absolutely. But the general trend is this is where the world is going. So the pale horse of disease follows after. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 24. So we're watching for the signs of Christ's coming. Now all these things, whether it's false religion, whether it's war, whether it's famine, whether it's disease, each of these things have been around forever. And yet, when Christ talks about them in this end time scenario, it's clear that they are going to continue to increase and grow larger and larger over the course of time. And we'll watch for those things to happen. It says in verse 8, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Now it's interesting, that term sorrows, beginning of sorrows, that term sorrows is often used in regard to childbirth. It's an interesting phrase. Sorrows, in sorrow you shall bear children. So it's referring to these birth pangs. It's saying that these events will be like birth pains. Now, when a woman has a child, I haven't had one, so I can't speak from experience, but I think I can relate to what others have gone through. Birth pains come in waves with several minutes or maybe longer between them. But they are intense and they are excruciating. For those that have experienced, some will say, oh, it was no big deal. Others will say, it just about killed me. But the point is, the pain comes on and it's intense, and then it disappears. And it's kind of like no pain at all. And a few minutes go by, and here comes this contraction, and it is a killer. And it just grows and grows and grows, basically till the point of birth. That transition period between early labor and late labor is excruciating in some respects. So what's the point? These events will not happen all at once. They'll happen, they'll be painful, and it will seem to back off. And then it'll come and strong again and then back off. But then it gets increasingly strong and much quicker in duration or in span of time between these periods of intensity and pain. So that's what he's talking about. These are the beginnings of sorrows. You'll see these things, but then it will seem to be fine. Then you'll see more and it'll be fine. Then it'll be more and then more and then more. And it'll increase in rapidity until the time of the birth. So then he gives his disciples some things to be aware of. Then, all these things are the beginning of sorrows. Then, they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Well, that's happy news. Thanks a lot. And yet, this literally would have happened to the disciples. They would see famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places, and yet the beginning of sorrows. So they would literally live through this themselves, and yet Christ was intending this for the future. He wasn't intending it prior to his first coming, or at the time of his first coming. He was clearly projecting ahead toward his second coming. And he makes that clear as he goes along, although the apostles would not have grasped that at that time. So they'll deliver you up to tribulation. Now again, who is he speaking to directly? Verse 3 told us that he's speaking to the disciples. They came to him privately. So he's talking to the 12. They would be the ones that would be delivered up to tribulation and killed. He said, you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Now pause for a second. Could this have applied only to the apostles at that day? No, all nations would really not be aware of what was going on. in the way that they can be today through mass media, through the internet, through Facebook. Facebook is now the largest nation on earth, if you think of it that way. More people on Facebook than live in the biggest nations put together. Fascinating. Fascinating to see how that can be the case. They will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Clearly, when we look forward, we realize there's a time of persecution of God's people coming. A time of persecution of God's people. We understand that that will be the case. We don't look forward to that, but it's the beginning of these things. Now, it is interesting. If you put your marker there, I'd like you to turn to Mark chapter 13. We've mentioned before that the Gospels are witnesses to Christ's life, the four witnesses we've called them. Mark adds some things when he records the Olivet prophecy in a slightly different way than Matthew does. He emphasizes things that he felt were important. After in verse 8, end of verse 8, the beginning of sorrows, again, as some translations literally render it, the beginning of birth pangs. But watch out for yourselves in verse 9, Mark 13, 9. Watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils. You'll be beaten in the synagogues. So clearly when Matthew wrote, and again, he would have written after the fact of Christ's death and resurrection, he clearly focuses mainly on the future fulfillment. Mark also talks about the current fulfillment. Will you ever be carried to a synagogue and beaten? And the answer is probably not. And yet, are there false churches out there that could do some of those things? Watch out for yourselves, verse 9. They'll deliver you up to councils. You'll be beaten in the synagogues. You'll be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony to them. So when we may be brought before governors or rulers or city councils or whomever it might be, it is for a testimony or witness for them. That will be the time when we will warn them what is coming. Here's what you are going to receive based on God's word if you don't repent. So we want them to repent. It'll be our opportunity to finally teach them, to give them a witness. Because largely the world is not listening at this point. It's not scary enough yet to listen. It's not frightening enough to listen. But that will be our opportunity to teach in a way that we do not have people's attention today. It does take scary things for people to really turn to God. And so that will be the case in the future. Then in verse 10, it tells us, and the gospel must first be preached to all nations. So while we see all these frightening things taking place, what must our focus be? It must be on the preaching of the gospel to all the nations. That's got to be our focus. We've often said, well, we just need to be a loving community and show the world love. Yeah, that's true. We should show the world love and kindness. But our focus really needs to be on the preaching of the gospel to the world. That does need to be our primary goal, that this gospel is preached to all nations. But when, verse 11, they arrest you and deliver you up, do not worry beforehand or premeditate what you'll speak, but whatever is given you in that hour, speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. So when those times of trouble come, we certainly can speak because it's God's Spirit that will be speaking through us. Verse 12, now a brother will betray a brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. The disciples certainly would have seen that kind of thing go on. It may be that we will see that kind of thing go on in the church as well. Verse 13, you'll be hated by all for my name's sake. Why? Because we're telling them that what they are receiving is a result of their sin. That's why we'll be hated. Not because we're bad people. Not because we're not great neighbors. Not because we don't help and care and do all we can for others. It's because we're telling them to stop sinning. And in general, what does it say? That men hate the light because their deeds were evil. So, we'll be hated for Christ's name's sake. But we're told, very encouragingly, but he who endures to the end, the same shall be saved. We'll be saved. So that's an encouraging thing. Let's close by looking at Luke's account. Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. Luke adds other detail that the other two gospel writers do not. Luke chapter 21, we'll pick it up in verse 16. Maybe verse 15, just to get some of the background there. For I'll give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. In other words, if you're brought before someone, you'll be able to reason in such a way that it cannot be resisted. Verse 16, you'll be betrayed even by parents, brothers, relatives, friends, and they will put some of you to death. So some will be martyred. Not all, probably not the majority by far, but some will. You'll be hated by all for my name's sake. But remember this, verse 18, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. So the vast majority, even though some will be put to death, and pretty typically, those put to death are the leadership. So not something I'm applying for, but generally that's been the case. But verse 18, not a hair of your head shall be lost. So what's required today? Verse 19, by your patience possess your souls. Patiently waiting for these things to come. Patiently waiting for God's intervention. Brethren, we have an exciting time ahead of us. We have the Feast of Trumpets coming up this week. And yet we have to look for what Christ said is coming. Let's anticipate the coming of Jesus Christ. And we'll go ahead at a future time and pick up from where we left off here to discuss what else are we looking for in awaiting Christ's return. So let's enjoy a wonderful Feast of Trumpets this week.